The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. One, thank you for coming. This is the first event of our new season. I think we're in our 15th year, but I've lost count, actually. Just a reminder to turn off your cell phones as usual, and we'll have a book signing afterward. And now we'll just launch in here. For more than half a century, Norman Podhoretz has been arguing the world in books, on the air, and in countless essays. The arguing began in 1955 when he became an assistant editor at a magazine called Commentary. 5 years later, he became the editor-in-chief of Commentary and remained in that position until 1995. Today, he is editor-at-large. Mr. Podhoretz is credited with the transformation of Commentary from a small Jewish monthly into one of the most influential forums for social criticism and American neoconservative ideas. His many books include memoirs, The Memoirs Making It, which traces his rise to power among the New York intellectuals, and Breaking Ranks, an explanation of his switch from liberalism to neoconservatism. His neoconservative or neo-nationalist perspective continues in his latest book, World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism, in which Mr. Podhoretz takes on the most controversial issue of our time, the war against the global network of terrorists. Arguing that the current war is as legitimate and as necessary as the two world wars and the Cold War, he lays out his case in defense of President Bush's policies and actions. Please welcome Norman Podhoretz.
Well, you can see me, I can't see you, which may be just as well. I'm going to start without a joke. I think this seems like a grim occasion. So, as far as I know, ladies and gentlemen, this new book of mine, World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism, is the first serious attempt to place 9/11 itself, the military campaigns that have followed it, and the war of ideas it has provoked at home into the context of the role the United States has played in the world since 1940. In doing this, my purpose is to show that the war into which we were plunged on 9/11/2001 cannot be understood, or perhaps, God help us, even won, unless we face up to the hard truth that it is a direct successor to the two world wars that immediately preceded it. That Afghanistan and Iraq are not wars in their own right, but fronts or theaters in the larger struggle. And that, like the Cold War, which in retrospect can now be seen more clearly as World War III, this new war, World War IV, will in all probability go on for some 3 or 4 decades. For today, in the monster with two heads, one religious and one secular, that is accordingly best described as Islamofascism, and in the states breeding, sheltering, and financing its terrorist armory, we are for the third time in some 60 years up against an aggressive and murderous totalitarian challenge to the liberal democratic world of which we were and still are the leading part. The first of these challenges came from the right, in the form of Nazism and its fascist allies, and we took it on and defeated it in World War II. The second came from the left, in the form of communism as embodied most dangerously in the Soviet Empire, and that one we took on and defeated in World War III. Now we are confronted with a new totalitarian challenge that comes from a religious force that was born in the 7th century But that, as the great historian Bernard Lewis has demonstrated, refashioned itself in the 20th century by taking lessons in how to organize and operate politically, first from the Nazis who occupied the Middle East in the 1940s, and then from the Soviets who replaced them in the 1950s. It then went on to equip itself with the technologies of the 21st century and is now striving mightily to add weapons of mass destruction to its terrorist armory. Now, there are those who claim that the Islamofascists are so much less powerful than their totalitarian predecessors of World War II and World War III that treating them as enemies in a great war actually dignifies them and wildly exaggerates the true dimensions of the threat they pose. But the paradoxical truth is that the Islamofascists are even more dangerous and difficult to beat than the Nazis or the communists. They have, as the commentator Daniel Pipes, who I believe lives in this city, as Pipes points out, an ideology capable of appealing to Muslims of every size and shape, from lumpen proletariat to privilege, from illiterates to PhDs, from the well-adjusted to psychopaths, from Yemenis to Canadians. And even Pipes adds, if we assume that the Islamofascists constitute only 10 to 15% of the Muslim population worldwide, they number some 125 to 200 million persons, or a far greater total than all the fascists and communists combined who ever lived, not to mention that they have a possible access to nuclear weapons that they are only too ready to use against us. But the objective of the Islamofascists is not merely to deploy these resources in order to murder as many of us as possible. Like the Nazis and the communists before them, they are dedicated to the destruction of the freedoms we cherish and for which America stands. It is these, then, that we, in our turn, no less than the greatest generation of the 1940s and its spiritual progeny of the 1950s and after, have a responsibility to uphold and to defend. Can we discharge that responsibility? Will we? The answer, I believe, will depend at least as much on the war being waged, what in World War II was called the home front, as on the bloody battles being fought by our armed forces in the Middle East. Unlike World War II, which just about everyone in America wholeheartedly supported, but like World War III, or the Cold War, when the domestic political scenes seethed with angry conflicts, World War IV has given rise to a war of ideas on the home front. One side consists of those of us who see Islamofascism as the latest mutation of the totalitarian threat to our civilization and who insist on the correlative necessity of meeting and defeating it by military means where necessary and where possible, by non-military instruments of power, economic, financial, political. On the other side of this war of ideas stand those who think that the threat is, as John Kerry has put it, a mere criminal nuisance, that's his word, like illegal gambling or prostitution, those were the two examples Kerry himself gave, that can be managed by the police and does not in any case rise to the level of requiring a military response. Now, in my judgment, the question of whether and to what extent the American people of this generation can or will shoulder the burden and discharge the responsibility that 9/11 imposed on us will ultimately be answered less by the fortunes of our troops in the field than by the outcome of this ferocious war of ideas at home. To be sure, the burdens of fighting World War IV differ from the ones Americans were asked to shoulder in World War II and World War III. In some ways, we today have it easier than the Americans who lived through those two wars. Rightly or wrongly, and for better or worse, this time there's no draft, there are no shortages or rationing, and taxes have not been raised. But on the other hand, we have more cause to be anxious over the safety and security of our continental homeland, which, it cannot be said too often, neither Hitler nor Stalin ever managed to strike, let alone with the weapons of mass destruction that the Islamofascist terrorists may well get their hands on before this war is over. Furthermore, because winning World War IV will almost certainly take as long to win as World War III did, Americans of this generation and the next are called upon to be far more patient than the greatest generation needed to be in World War II, in which the United States was involved for only 4 years. And facing an enemy in the Islamo-fascist who's even more elusive than the communists, the American people of today are required to summon at least as much perseverance as the American people of those days did for all their bitching and moaning over the 42 long years of World War III. The same is true in the area of morale. In the run-up to our entry into World War II, there was a good deal of anti-war sentiment coming from isolationists and pacifists, both on the left and the right. But hardly any of it survived Pearl Harbor. Nor, once we were in the war, was there any visible or openly expressed defeatism, not even in response to actual defeats. And we suffered many, especially in the early years. In World War III, by contrast, great bouts of defeatist sentiment did get aroused by critics, both of the left, who thought we were being too aggressive, and of the right, who thought we were not being aggressive enough. Defeatism was also reinforced by angry recriminations over whether and or how this or that battle should have been fought. And the battles in dispute were not only military, as in Korea, and to a much larger extent Vietnam, but also political, as in the passionate debates over arms control and détente. In addition, they were ideological, as over the question of whether the enemy was Soviet expansionism in particular or communism in general, or our own paranoid delusions. The first 6 years of World War IV have been marked by versions of all these features, but today the forces promoting defeatism are more powerful than they ever were in the past. We who believe in the absolute necessity of fighting and winning World War IV can complain all we like, and we do complain, about the conditions that have bred so much defeatism and from which our morale will continue to suffer to an extent undreamed of in World War II, and even more than it did in World War III. But these are the conditions under which World War IV will have to be fought, if it is to be fought at all. And if it is to be fought at all, it will also have to be fought by the kind of people Americans now are. You know, before the United States entered World War II, serious doubts were raised as to whether we were a match for such disciplined and fanatical enemies as Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And in World War III, leading anti-communists like Whittaker Chambers and James Burnham were sure that we lacked the stomach, the heart, the will, and the wit to stand effectively against the true believers of the Soviet Union and its allies and sympathizers. To Chambers, we were the losing side. That's what he said when he quit the Communist Party. I'm joining the losing side. And to James Burnham, we were veritably suicidal in our liberal weakness and folly. Well, they turned out to be wrong because, as just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Charles Horner of the Hudson Institute would put it in speaking of Chambers, they, and not they alone, failed to anticipate the resiliency of the American citizenry and its leadership. Today, as we all know, similar doubts and fears are once again flying all over the place, with even some who would like to believe otherwise murmuring that we've all grown too soft, too self-indulgent, and too self-absorbed to meet an even more daunting challenge from an enemy who is so much readier to die for his beliefs than most of us are. It's also being said that we've grown so complacent since 9/11/2001 that nothing short of another terrorist attack here at home will shake us back into the realization that we're actually at war. It would be foolish to deny that there's some basis for such doubts and fears, and yet it would surely be just as foolish to repeat the mistake of Chambers and Burnham in failing to anticipate the resiliency of the American citizenry and its leadership. As to the citizenry, we need only point to the young Americans in uniform, all volunteers, who've been bearing the heaviest burden of World War IV. In their determination, their courage, and their love of country, they are by all accounts a match, and more than a match, for their forebears of World War II and World War III. And who is to say that these young people are less representative of America than such of their elders and contemporaries who lack the same virtues? Where did these people come from? Where were they bred and raised? And where did they absorb the right stuff? On the moon? No, it was in the America of today. It is an America as invisible to the eyes of the liberal culture as it was in 1972 when Pauline Kael, the film critic of The New Yorker, notoriously wondered how Nixon could have won by a landslide when she knew not a single person who had voted for him. But this still invisible America still exists, even in some still invisible enclaves of New York City itself. When, however, we turn to leadership, the other factor whose resiliency Horner said Chambers and Burnham underestimated, doubts like theirs are harder to avoid. Not that I, contrary to most people, have any doubts about the leadership of George W. Bush. In fact, I believe that in significant respects, which I spell out in my book, Bush bears a strong political resemblance to Harry Truman, whose ratings at this point in World War III were even lower than Bush's, down 22%, but who is now universally recognized as a great president. The reason is that Truman recognized the Soviet threat when many were poo-pooing it and enunciated through the Truman Doctrine a strategy known as containment for meeting it. This is precisely what George W. Bush has done with regard to Islamofascism. I analyze the Bush Doctrine in great detail in my book, but it can, without too much distortion, be summarized as a long-range strategy designed to make the Middle East safe for America by making it safe for democracy, with preemption as the main military instrument and democratization as its main political instrument. So far as resiliency goes, a good measure of it is the buoyancy Bush has exhibited even during the darkest moments of his presidency. At this very moment, with about 15 months left to him, he shows in his conduct of the war none of the usual symptoms of lame duckery and all the signs of energy and resolve. But he does have only about 15 months to go. And it's in speculating who might succeed him that my own doubts begin to arise. Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson are at this point the two Republican frontrunners, and if either one of them, but especially Giuliani, should win in 2008, chances are that the Bush Doctrine will remain our guiding strategy. But suppose that a Democrat should become president in 2008. What then? Here, too, in my book, I look back for help at Truman, this time to see how his doctrine fared while he was still in office and what happened to it after he left. From the moment it was first enunciated in 1947, the strategy of containment, which flowed from the Truman Doctrine, like the Bush Doctrine of today, was attacked from the right as well as the left, and as if that were not enough, from the center, too. In the election of 1948, Truman had the seemingly impossible task of confronting all these challenges and a few others as well. When, against what every poll had predicted, he succeeded in warding them all off, and in defeating the Republican candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, he could reasonably claim that the American people were behind the main principles of his foreign policy. Even so, enough bitter opposition remained within and around the Republican Party to leave it uncertain as to whether containment was an American policy or only the policy of the Democrats. This uncertainty was exacerbated by the presidential election of 1952, when the Republicans chose Dwight D. Eisenhower as their candidate and the Democrats went with Adlai Stevenson because Truman had become so unpopular that he chose not to run. It was a campaign featuring strident attacks on the Truman Doctrine by Eisenhower's running mate, Richard Nixon, and Eisenhower's future Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. Nixon, for example, mocked Stevenson, who promised to continue on the course set by the Truman Doctrine as a graduate of the cowardly College of Communist Containment presided over by Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson. While Dulles repeatedly called for ditching containment in favor of a policy of rollback and liberation, yet when Eisenhower came into office, he hardly touched a hair on the head of the Truman Doctrine. Far from adopting a bolder and more aggressive strategy, the new president ended the by then extremely unpopular Korean War, in which, incidentally, 10 times as many Americans were killed as in Iraq today. And it was a very, even more unpopular war than Iraq has been. He ended that war on the basis of the status quo ante, in other words, precisely on the terms of containment. Even more telling was Eisenhower's refusal 3 years later to intervene when the Hungarians, apparently encouraged by the rhetoric of liberation still being employed in the broadcasts of Radio Free Europe, when the Hungarians rose up in revolt against their Soviet masters. For better or worse, this finally dispelled any lingering doubt as to whether containment was the policy just of the Democratic Party. With full bipartisan support behind it, the Truman Doctrine had become the official policy of the United States of America. And the analogy is obviously not perfect, but the resemblances between the political battles that were fought in the early years of World War III and the ones that have been fought in the first 6 years of World War IV are still very striking. If in January 2009 a Democrat should be sworn in as President of the United States, will he or she, as for once reality in the shape of Hillary Clinton rather than political correctness demands that we add, will he or she, like Eisenhower, you should have laughed at that one, huh? Will he or she, like Eisenhower, with respect to Republican derision of the Truman Doctrine in 1952, quietly shelve the frenetic attacks of the Democrats on the Bush Doctrine? Will he or she then tacitly acknowledge that there is no serious alternative to the strategy it prescribes other than returning to the law enforcement approach through which we dealt so ineffectually with terrorism before 9/11 and or submitting to the craven will of the Europeans and the corrupt ministrations of the UN? Will he or she realize that no matter how such a shift might be dressed up and spun, it would, and rightly, be interpreted by our enemies as a cowardly retreat? Will he or she understand that the despotisms of the Middle East would then once again feel free to offer sanctuary and launching pads to Islamo-fascist terrorists? Will he or she realize that these terrorists would be emboldened to attack us again and on an infinitely greater scale than before? And on the home front, will he or she cease and desist from raising false alarms about the threat to civil liberties posed by programs essential to protecting us from just such terrorist attacks, programs like the surveillance of certain international phone calls or the tracking of bank deposits? Will he or she stop defining torture down to the point where it becomes impossible to conduct any interrogation at all of captured terrorists, therefore depriving us of the intelligence that is also necessary if further attacks are to be prevented? Now, from the way the Democrats have been acting and speaking, especially since Bush's reelection in 2004, all of the answers to these questions would seem to be no. But is it too much to hope that these denials of reality are only the luxurious indulgences of opposition, and that a Democratic president, like the Republicans after 1952, will be forced by the awesome responsibilities of power to forego all these luxurious indulgences and to take up where Bush will have left off? Not that, if this were to happen, a perfect bipartisan harmony would descend upon the nation. After all, contrary to the roseate reminiscences of how it was then, not even the bipartisan consensus that was reached after 1952 eliminated all discord. Plenty of it remained, and I have the scars to prove it. And it was periodically exacerbated by such reverses as the Bay of Pigs under Kennedy, Vietnam under Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, Iran under Carter, and Iran-Contra under Reagan. There was also a long stretch during which it looked as though our enemies were so strong and we so debilitated that many among us, Republicans no less than Democrats, thought that the best we could do was, in effect, to sue for a negotiated peace. All this was even worse and more humiliating, if not necessarily more consequential, than the worst-case scenario of a cut-and-run withdrawal from Iraq being urged upon us at this very moment by the political descendants of the anti-war activists and the defeatists of World War III. But God be thanked, we eventually pulled ourselves up and out of the slough of despond. And because we did, we were rewarded with a victory that freed us from a military, political, and ideological threat. Moreover, to the people living both within the Soviet Union itself and in its East European Empire, our victory brought liberation from a totalitarian tyranny. Admittedly, not everything came up roses immediately after liberation, but it would be ridiculous to contend that nothing changed for the better when communism landed on the very ash heap of history that Marx had predicted would be the final resting place of capitalism. I suppose that we hang in long enough to carry World War IV to a comparably successful conclusion. What will victory bring this time around? Well, to us, it will bring the elimination of another, and to say it again, in some respects, greater threat to our safety and security. And because that threat cannot be eliminated without draining the swamps in which it breeds, victory will also entail the liberation of another group of countries from another species of totalitarian tyranny. As we can already see from Afghanistan and Iraq, liberation will no more result in the overnight establishment of ideal conditions in the Middle East than it has done in East Europe or Russia. But as in East Europe, better things will immediately happen and a genuine opportunity will be opened up for even better things to come. Of course, many of Bush's critics question or totally reject the idea that democratization represents the best and perhaps even the only way to defeat Islamofascism and the terrorism it uses as its main weapon against us. Bush has placed his bet on a belief in the universality of the desire for freedom and for the prosperity that freedom produces. But what if he's wrong? What if the Middle East is incapable of democratization? What if the peoples of that region do not wish to be as free and as prosperous as we are? And what if Islam as a religion is by its very nature incompatible with democracy? These are hard questions about which reasonable people can and do differ. But those of us who back Bush's bet have our own set of doubts about the doubts of the doubters. For one thing, they forget that the miserable despotisms of the Middle East have shallow roots. They were not created by Allah or Muhammad in the 7th century, but by the British and the French after World War I. In addition, the doubters seem to assume that Arabs and or Muslims are so different from most of their fellow human beings that they actually like being pushed around and repressed and beaten and killed by thugs, whether dressed in military uniforms or wearing clerical garb. For our part, we wonder whether Muslims really do prefer being poor and hungry and ill-housed to enjoying the comforts and conveniences that we in the West take so totally for granted that we no longer remember to be grateful for them. In defending the political component of the Bush Doctrine, Victor Davis Hanson, the military historian and classicist, writes, and I'm quoting here, "We long tried almost everything else. Accepting dictators on their own terms did not bring stability, but constant war, oil embargoes, and terrorism from the 1960s onward. Replying to two decades of terrorist attacks, from the Iranian hostage-taking in 1979 to the attack on the USS Cole in 2000, with indictments and a few cruise missiles, only emboldened the jihadists. And staging coups or propping up authoritarians in Iran or the Gulf simply radicalized the Middle East." Hanson then makes a surprising point about what the U.S. is trying to do in the Middle East. He says, in fostering democracy in Afghanistan and Iraq was not our first but our last choice. It was not a good option, only a bad one when the other alternatives had proven far worse. Well, in my own opinion, bad as this option may have been by certain political standards, it was and still is marked by more than a touch of nobility. but I fully endorse Hansen's conclusion that constitutional government or messy democracy is the one course that might someday free Middle Easterners from kidnapping, suicide bombers, and dictators in sunglasses, while at the same time freeing us from the global reach of Islamo-fascist terrorism. In any event, according to the great historian Bernard Lewis, we have no choice. Either, he says, and these are his words, we bring them freedom or they destroy us. Those of us who support the Bush Doctrine also take issue with the view that democracy and capitalism can grow only in a soil that's been cultivated for centuries. We often point out that in the aftermath of World War II, the United States managed within a single decade to transform both Germany and Imperial Japan into capitalist democracies. And in the aftermath of the defeat of communism in World War III, a similar process got underway on its own steam in Central and Eastern Europe, and even before Vladimir Putin slammed on the brakes in the old heartland of the evil empire itself. Furthermore, as we are reminded by Fuad Ajami, a native of the region, in 15 of the 29 democratic countries in 1970, democratic regimes were midwifed by foreign rule or had come into being right after independence from foreign occupation. Why, he asks, and so do I, why not the Muslim world? Listen again to Bernard Lewis, who says this about the common view that Islamic peoples are incapable of decent civilized government. And I quote, it shows ignorance of the Arab past, contempt for the Arab presence, and unconcern for the Arab future. To this, in turn, the counter frequently is, look at Iraq. The Bush administration, misled by neocons like me, wildly underestimated the special difficulties of democratizing Iraq, even assuming it to be possible at all. Well, I confess to have been among those who failed to anticipate the ferocity of the opposition to democratization that would develop, and therefore how long so great a transformation would take. But like President Bush, I remained and still am convinced that it can and will be achieved if we can stay the course. For, in the words of Donald Rumsfeld, as long as it takes and not a day longer. How long would that be? For those who oppose the Bush Doctrine, a year or even a month after the end of major combat operations was already much too much, and they're now demanding an early or even an immediate withdrawal. For those of us who continue to support the Bush Doctrine, as long as it takes means until the day when the Iraqis are able to assume the lion's share of responsibility for ensuring the irreversibility of the progress they have already made toward the establishment of a loosely federated republic that still seems, given the stakes, the only satisfactory formula. As with democratization, so with the reform and modernization of Islam. In considering this even more difficult question, we find ourselves asking whether Islam can really go on for all eternity, resisting the kind of internal reformation and modernization that began within Christianity and Judaism in the early modern period. Not that we are so naive as to imagine that Islam can be reformed overnight or from the outside. There is, however, at least a fighting chance that a clearing of the ground and a sowing of the seeds out of which new political, economic, and social conditions can grow will gradually give rise to correlative religious pressures from within. Such pressures would take the form of an ultimately irresistible demand on theologians and clerics to find warrants in the Quran and the Sharia under which it would be possible to remain a good Muslim while enjoying the blessings of decent government and even of political and economic liberty. In this way, a course might finally be set toward the reform and modernization of the Islamic religion itself. But what about us here in America? On what course are we now set? In his first State of the Union address, President Bush tried to answer that question by affirming that history had called upon America to fight freedom's fight, a fight he also characterized as a unique opportunity for us to seize. In this language, we can hear an echo of the concluding paragraphs of George F. Kennan's X essay, written under the pseudonym X, which he wrote at the outbreak of World War III. And this is what Kennan said. The issue of Soviet-American relations is in essence a test of the overall worth of the United States as a nation among nations. To avoid destruction, the United States need only measure up to its own best traditions and prove itself worthy of preservation as a great nation. And Kennan then went on to his peroration. And I'm quoting again. In the light of these circumstances, the thoughtful observer of Russian-American relations will experience a certain gratitude for a providence which, by providing the American people with this implacable challenge, has made their entire security as a nation dependent on their pulling themselves together and accepting the responsibilities of moral and political leadership that history plainly intended for them to bear. Well, substitute Islamofascism for Russian-American relations in that passage, and every other word of this magnificent statement applies to us as a nation today. In 1947, we accepted the responsibilities of moral and political leadership that history plainly intended for us to bear. And for the next 42 years, we acted on them. We may not always have acted on them wisely or well, and we often did so only after much kicking and screaming. But act on them we did. We thereby ensured our own preservation as a great nation, while also bringing a better life to millions upon millions of people in a major region of the world. But is the country we have now become ready to measure up to its own best traditions and prove itself worthy of preservation as a great nation? Do we, the American people of this generation, have it in us to beat back the implacable challenge of Islamofascism, as the greatest generation of World War II did in taking on the Nazis and their fascist allies, and as its children and grandchildren ultimately managed to do in confronting the Soviet Union and its communist empire in World War III? Well, in spite of how bleak the prospects look 6 years after 9/11/2001, I persist in thinking that we do and that we will, but only on one condition. Only if those of us who see the struggle against Islamofascism as a world war against the latest mutation of the totalitarian challenge to our civilization, only if those of us who see it that way can prevail in the war of ideas here at home against those who never knew or have forgotten or have lost sight of what we are fighting against, what we are fighting for, and why we have to win. It is as a contribution to that war of ideas that I wrote this book and that I offer it to you now. Thank you very much.
Folks, if you raise your hands, if you have a question, we'll get a mic to you. We'll try to get to you, as many of you as we can. Please wait for the mic, gentlemen in the third row.
Recently, John Murtha said that if we pull out from Iraq and there's a bloodbath, it won't be our fault. It'll be the we shouldn't feel guilty for the ensuing bloodbath. It would be the fault of the Iraqis. Could you comment on that?
Well, I disagree with that statement. I think that if we do pull out precipitously, and there is a bloodbath, as there almost certainly will be, we will bear a large measure of responsibility for it. You know, when we got out of Vietnam in 1973, there was not a... I bet you if I gave a test to this audience and asked you, how many American soldiers were there in Vietnam in 1975 when that helicopter scurried off the roof of the embassy in Saigon with people desperately clinging onto it? Does anybody wish to hazard a guess? How many American soldiers were there in Vietnam at that point? Zero. Zero. Not one. Not one. We left Vietnam in 1973 after the Paris Peace Accords with a promise that if the North Vietnamese were to invade, We would supply weapons, ammunition and some air support to help the South Vietnamese resist a takeover by the communists of North Vietnam. When this happened, and when the North Vietnamese, supplied by the Soviet Union, marched there, not a guerrilla army, but a regular army with divisions and tanks, who were storming the gates of Saigon itself, Congress refused to send a single bullet to those people, not one. I think this is one of the shames of our history, of our past. It dishonored our country, and I think that if we were to do something similar in Iraq, we would also be dishonoring ourselves.
Another question. Gentleman here on the left, third row, on your left.
Mike, why Iraq? Afghanistan was the source of 9/11. It had all of the terrorists there.
Well, not
Iraq
all.
Trained us, and we didn't put in enough resources to Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is now going downhill. Afghanistan could have been the standard for democratization.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I have a good answer. You have to look at both Afghanistan and Iraq as campaigns within a larger strategy. I tried to describe that strategy earlier as making the Middle East safe for America by making it safe for democracy. When we went after Afghanistan, we were going after one head of the two-headed monster that I call Islamo-fascism, the Islamo part, the religious part that was most saliently embodied in the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. The secular part, the fascist part, Islamo-fascist, was most saliently embodied by Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And the reason that we went into Iraq, and the reason I believe we were right to go into Iraq, is that if the long-range strategy of draining the swamps in which Islamo-fascism breeds were to succeed, it was necessary to topple the leading fascist despotism of that de facto alliance. And we did that. We then ran into trouble, bigger trouble than we anticipated. And incidentally, I believe that the ferocity of the opposition that's been mounted to us in Iraq by a combination of local Baathists, Al-Qaeda, by the way, not all the terrorists, as you put it, were in Afghanistan, and by jihadists imported from outside Iraq, the ferocity of the opposition is actually a perverse tribute to the success of the process of democratization. I mean, if those people thought that this process was doomed to fail, they would not be blowing themselves up in order to derail it. In any event, it's taken 3 years for the American military, for the president, the Pentagon, to come up with the right strategy for dealing with this insurgency. There's nothing at all unusual about that in wars. I mean, it took Lincoln 3 years to find Sherman and Grant after being frustrated by the incompetence of McClellan and other generals. He pointed actually six generals until he found the winning combination. I think we found the winning combination now. I don't agree that Afghanistan is going downhill. It's having great troubles. Well, you can laugh. Okay, you think it's going downhill. Good luck to you. But I don't think it's going downhill. I think it's having its internal difficulties, as might have been expected, as in fact even I expected when I was optimistic about the prospects. The truth of the matter is that you have these societies, both in Afghanistan and Iraq, were suffering for many, many years under ferocious despotisms, and to recover from the after effects of that kind of experience, especially when, as in Afghanistan, there was no history whatever of free elections. For example, the first free election held in Afghanistan was the one held under our auspices after the toppling of the Taliban. It just takes a long time. I mean, it took 10 years after World War II for Germany to find its way onto the path of democratization. It took 10 years for Japan. You know, as I think General Petraeus has said, the political clock in Washington runs a lot faster than the clock of reality in the Middle East. And that's, again, a factor that we have to live with if we want to win this war. But the truth of the matter is that 3-4 years is, by historical standards, a very short period for the kind of transformation that's being attempted here. And the price we paid in blood and treasure is, by historical standards, very low.
Another question in the third row right here. Fourth row. 1, 2, 3, 4.
What is your view, sir, when dealing with the nuclear threat from Iran?
Well, as some of you may know, I wrote what is a highly notorious article in the left-wing blogosphere called The Case for Bombing Iran. Thanks to that article, I've been called a pathological scum, a war criminal, a superannuated Zionist hack, and those are only the politest of the epithets that have been hurled at me. My view is, I argued in that article, and I argue in this book as well to some extent, but more elaborately in that article, that none of the measures that are being attempted to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear capability, that is to say diplomacy, sanctions, or the promotion of an internal insurrection, none of these can work. They haven't worked, they won't work, and there are ways of evading the terrible choice that faces us in reality, which is, as John McCain put it, and the new French president Sarkozy and his foreign minister Kushner also put it, the choice is between allowing Iran to get the bomb or bombing Iran. And McCain said the only thing worse than bombing Iran is allowing Iran to get the bomb. In addition to the fact that the Iranians have been waging war on us, proxy war on us in Iraq and through Hezbollah, not to mention the constant barrage that's been coming at us from them since the Ayatollah Khomeini took over and seized our hostages in 1979. So the answer is, I think most people agree that it would be terrible if the Iranians acquired a nuclear capability. Hardly anybody disagrees about that. People disagree that military action is necessary or desirable, and so they hope that one of these other tactics will work. I believe that the evidence is overwhelming that they won't work, they can't work, and we will soon be up against the choice of either taking military action or facing the consequences of an Iranian nuclear capability. I also believe, and I see more and more people are coming around to that view. I was for a while the only person on earth, except for the extreme left, who believed that President Bush will not leave office with Iran in possession of a nuclear bomb or in imminent possession of a nuclear bomb. I think he will take military action, and I hope he does. With airplanes. There would only be no troops. Nobody is advocating an invasion of Iran. What people are advocating is airstrikes on the nuclear facilities. Some are underground and others are above ground. We can get the ones above ground, which would retard them for 5 years or so, and who knows what can happen in that amount of time. And we can also, with bunker busters, get the underground ones, some of them, if assuming the intelligence is good enough. And I think probably it is.
We've got a question on this side, and then we'll head back here.
I would like to say, I when I first heard the terminology World War IV, several years ago, before you were the one that started it or not, I adopted it immediately, and in engaging people in conversation on this the war that we're in, I try to avoid using the word. I use the word, but use it front and campaign to define it, because that's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
What I question you is,
I'm glad somebody in this room agrees with me.
I agree with you 100%. The president.
Thank you. Well, now I feel less lonely.
Well, the question I ask is, why has the president failed to define the issues by using terminology such as you've used to engage the press and Hollywood as an arm of propaganda. Nobody can win a war unless you control the propaganda within the nation to gain the support of the public. And by using terms like Islam is a religion of peace, and then and jumping around on all this terminology and not sticking to a format, he's really lost the plot.
Yeah.
It's like he's put the audience in a bad show to sleep.
Yeah. Well, I agree that it's I would think his largest failing in leading the country in this war has been the failure to name the enemy by its proper name and call the war by its proper name. In my book, I explain why I think he avoided calling the enemy Islamo-fascism or Islamist extremism. The main reason was that not only the president, but practically everybody in Washington was terrified of making it seem that we were going to war against the whole, you know, all 200 million Muslims. You know, 10% is enough. And it's a reasonable estimate that the Islamo-fascists and their sympathizers amount to 10 to 15% of the Islamic world. And that, as I said earlier, means 150 to 200 million people. That's enough to be fighting. We don't have to fight all 200 million of them. So they were worried about conveying that impression. Perhaps they were overly concerned, though I do know that for a brief moment when the president, partly under the urging of some of us, began using the term Islamic fascism, the roof fell in on him, and he backed away after about a week. As for the World War IV, I did not originate that term. It was originated by the military historian Elliot Cohen, but he and some of the others who picked it up backed away from it very soon, because people were saying, well, what happened to World War III? Did I sleep through it? You know? And so you say World War IV, and immediately you have to explain that World War III was the Cold War, and it gets to be too complicated. So for reasons, really, of avoiding confusion, he did not call it World War IV. Let me just explain to those of you who are sympathetic but puzzled about about calling it World War IV. The main reason that Elliot Cohen and I and Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director under Clinton, all use that term is that we believe, we're convinced that this war bears a much closer resemblance to the Cold War, which we now call World War III, than it does to World War II. It has many features in common. It has an ideological base. It will call upon many different instruments of power, not just military. It will likely last a long time, covering a very wide area with an elusive enemy. So to call it World War III, as I know the White House contemplated doing for a while, would also be misleading, make it sound like World War II and be over in 4 years. And the president has repeatedly said that this is the work of generations, that he's just starting the process. And I think, again, the comparison with Truman is very apt. Truman got it going. He was in office for about 5 years, just a little less than Bush will have been when he left. And the process had started, and it had started badly. As I say, he was, if anybody had told you in 1952 that Harry Truman would someday be looked upon as a great president, it would have been laughed out of the room. He was considered by most people possibly the worst president we had ever had. So I think that the failure to name things by their proper names has been a disability in this war, no question about it, though I understand why the failure came about. As for enlisting the media and Hollywood, as we say in Yiddish, anechtige tog, which means it ain't going to happen, no matter what anybody does. You could have Demosthenes running the White House and Hollywood, Sean Penn and Susan Sarandon would still be saying what they're saying, and the New York Times would still be bloviating in its unctuous manner. You're not going to win the, you're not going to win these people over. And as I said in my talk, and I want to stress that, we can complain all we like about this, and I'm second to none in complaining about it. But it's a condition with which we now have to live. It's not going to be changed, and a way has to be found around it. I mean, we have to win this war in spite of that obstacle. It's an obstacle that was not faced by this country in World War II, quite the contrary. I mean, my God, if you had had today's media in World War II, Hitler would have been running Europe. I mean, no question about it. Eisenhower would have been strung up or certainly kicked out after D-Day and certainly after the Battle of the Bulge. I won't go on with this, but... the fact is, there's a wonderful passage in my book, by the way, quoted from James Q. Wilson, in which he imagines a series of news stories in World War II about various things that happens. It's actually quite funny, but mordantly funny. So there's no chance of enlisting the domestic insurgency, as I sometimes call it. And we're a country that is free, and there's going to be this kind of opposition, as there was at crucial moments in the Cold War, World War III. We managed to prevail against it, and we're going to have to learn how to do that again. I mean, I'm not going to live to see it, but I have faith that it will be done.
Folks, a couple more, well, maybe a few more than a couple more questions. Gentlemen in the denim shirt about nine rows back.
I find it remarkable that in a 45-minute lecture on Islamofascism and its current locus, the Middle East, neither the word Israel nor the word Jew is ever mentioned until you said an ethnic it took. Baruma, reviewing your book in the New York Review, one of those current insurgencies that you talk about, quotes you from your 1963 essay about playgrounds in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Occupied by people of color who were then called Negroes and Jews. Quote, quoting you, "There is a fight. They win and we retreat, half whimpering, half with bravado. My first experience of cowardice." What was your second experience of cowardice?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. That piece, by the way, is a disgrace, and not because it attacked me, but to trace the origin of a large intellectual movement like neoconservatism to the fact that I got beaten up by Negroes when I was 11 years old is the most vulgar form of pop psychologizing you can possibly imagine. It's also, in a way, perversely flattering to me. I mean, God, if I had known that taking those beatings was going to result in, changing the whole world, I would have been happier to take them. I'll tell you about cowardice and being a kid in the streets of Brownsville, Brooklyn in the 1930s. I was more afraid of backing away from a fight than of getting beaten up. The consequence, because you backed away, you were called a sissy or a yellow or chicken. And that was far more terrifying than getting beaten up. The result was that I got beaten up quite a lot. But I did not back away from fights. That quote you cited had to do not with me, but with a basketball team driven from a playground. The bad taste of fear in the face of a fight was as nothing compared to what I would have suffered and what others did suffer by backing away from a fight. So yes, it's true. I certainly feel that it's better to fight when challenged than to surrender, absolutely, and to take the risk of being wounded and maybe even killed. I once almost was killed by being hit on the head with a baseball bat. But that this has anything to do with my political beliefs of today strikes me as a very dubious proposition.
Another couple of questions. Right here, third row. Excuse me. We'll get to you.
President Carter helped engineer the downfall of the Shah. Do you think we would be in the situation we're in now if he hadn't done that?
By the way, I forgot to say that this is a historic first for me. It's the first time I've ever been accused of not talking about the Jews and Israel, rather than dwelling on them obsessively. So it's a relief. Of course, I mean, Israel is not a central issue in World War IV, although many people try to make it one, including Carter and people like Brzezinski, who was his national security advisor, who think that if somehow peace were arrived at between Palestinians and Israel, then everybody else in the Middle East would say, okay, that's fine, everything is, we'll go home, lay down our weapons, it's wonderful, now we'll all lie down with the lamb. It's ridiculous. There have been 22 wars in the Middle East since the establishment of the State of Israel, not a single one of which of those 22 had anything to do whatever with Israel, and the total number of Arabs and the Muslims killed in those wars exceeds by a hundredfold the number of people killed in the six Arab-Israeli wars. And, I mean, even the Iran-Iraq war alone was involved, I'm bad at numbers, over a million, I think. Carter and the Shah. Well, that's a very good question. I have studied this whole situation. I yield to no one in my contempt for Jimmy Carter. I even felt contempt for him before he came out of the closet as an anti-Semite. So I was there at the present at the creation. I think that it was inconceivable that Carter would have come to the aid of the Shah when the Khomeini revolution broke out, for a lot of reasons that take too long to go into. And, you know, his ambassador to the United Nations, Andrew Young, you can believe this or not, but you could look it up, as they used to say, actually said that Khomeini was a saint and a great believer in human rights. That was Carter's ambassador. Well, with that attitude, it wasn't likely that he was going to sort of give a green light to the Shah to kill a lot of people, as he would have had to do to head off that revolution. If it had been possible to do such a thing, that is to fend off Khomeini, the whole subsequent history would have been different, because from a certain point of view, you can say World War IV started in 1979, and it actually started even before that. You know, we were being hit by Islamo-fascist terrorist attacks way back, beginning in 1970, under Republican administrations, Democratic administrations, even under Reagan, the toughest president I suppose we've had in this period, and we did not respond to these attacks as acts of war, which they were. I mean, you attack an American warship, the USS Cole, that is a clear act of war that would traditionally demand a military response. We treated all of these things as random criminal acts to be handled by the cops and the courts. And it was only when, and even the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 was treated the same way by the Clinton administration. So the fact is that only 9/11, 2001, what happened then, this was the boldest of all the attacks, and what it made a lot of people realize is that there were people who were making war on us, and it was time to fight back. I mean, that's actually what happened, and what Bush basically came out and said and acted upon. If Khomeini had not taken over, if Iran had not fallen under this Islamo-fascist malocracy, the world would today be a much safer place. Yes.
Okay, we are going to have to limit it to a couple of questions. In the blue, 1, 2, 3, 4 rows back here.
Thank you for your very thoughtful and thought-provoking presentation. And I think the parallels that you drew between World War III and World War IV are very helpful ways to think about it. But isn't one of the main lessons to learn from World War III is that the use of troops in Korea and Vietnam was not what led to the victory of World War III? And how do we compare that to what's going on now with the use of troops?
Well, I don't really accept the premise of your question. I mean, it's late. And I wrote a whole book called Why We Were in Vietnam, which I commend to your attention if you want to know how I would answer your question at length if I had time. But even Korea, you can argue, which some people say we lost, others say we fought to a stalemate. We actually never intended to conquer the North. The policy was to prevent the North from taking over the South. A good case can be made for the need to have done that at that period. But look, a lot of different things happened in the Cold War, World War III, and a lot of people thought it could not be won and should not be won, because the only way to win it would be to provoke a nuclear war. And that was the rationale behind the policy of détente, which was a Republican policy, not a Democratic policy. So when Reagan came along, and Reagan was asked, what is your conception of the Cold War? He said, my conception of the Cold War is very simple. We win, they lose. This was a wholly new attitude, because the assumption was that nobody could win. It was a stalemate, and that we would have to make an accommodation with the Soviet Union and sort of live for all eternity in some kind of uneasy tension with the Soviet Union. I would say, looking back, if I were writing a history of World War III, and there are a couple of pretty good ones now, one by John Lewis Gaddis, who was an opponent of Vietnam, and has changed his mind about a lot of things in that war. He's a professor at Yale. It's a good book. If I were writing a history, I would actually take the position that practically almost everything we did contributed to that victory, and many of the things we failed to do delayed that victory unnecessarily, and a lot of people had to suffer for that. But it was a long war. A lot of mistakes were made. A lot of reverses were suffered, just as happening now and will happen again. And as I say in my book, which I hope at least a few of you will read or at least buy, the mistakes that have been alleged in against the Bush administration, even assuming that they were all mistakes rather than judgment calls that might have gone worse if it had been decided the other way, even if you grant that every single one of those alleged mistakes was actually a mistake, they amount to chump change compared to the mistakes that were made by great leaders like Roosevelt and Churchill, and that cost many tens of thousands of lives. I mean, thinking about the invasion of Italy, where, I don't know, more Americans got killed in the first day in Anzio than in the 3 years of Iraq. And it was a totally unnecessary operation from a military point of view. The Battle of the Bulge, where I forget how many American 20,000 I think died. We went into that with faulty intelligence. The poor bastards, the battered bastards, the Bastogne as they were called, were ill-equipped. And when I say ill-equipped, I mean they didn't have winter clothing or winter boots, so that something like 10,000 cases of gangrene resulted. As I say, if that had happened, this time, I mean, every single official would have been strung up. And what did we know about the Battle of the Bulge? What did the American people knew about the Battle of the Bulge? That the commanding general, upon being asked by the German commander to surrender, said nuts. He almost certainly said something a lot stronger than nuts, but in those days you couldn't print the F word in the newspapers. So it became nuts, and it got to be represented as a heroic victory when, in fact, it was an intelligence and logistical and command disaster. What I'm trying to say here is that this is the nature of war, and it's the nature of any large enterprise. It's there. I was in the Army. What is it? Over 50 years ago. And you know what they used to say in World War II, and they were still saying it when I was in the Korean period, snafu, that was the word. You know what snafu means? Situation normal, all effed up. That was the definition of life in the Army. Life in the Army was, they woke you up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you rushed, you got dressed, ready, ran, jumped on trucks, sped to some destination, and then waited 5 hours before somebody told you what to do there. That was a typical experience of the Army, and believe it or not, that happens in combat too, although a lot less in this war. Then the point I'm trying to make is that there's an impatience with the timing and standards of perfection that are so totally unreal that they couldn't possibly be met, that have been applied to the campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that no war, not even the best of them, like World War II, could have been fought under such imperatives of perfection.
Folks, we have time for one last question. Gentlemen all the way in back there. No, sir, there's a man behind you.
Sir, I would never disrespect you by calling you, I don't know, an out-of-touch dinosaur. And I'm sure that...
How about a superannuated Zionist hack?
No, I would certainly never use that one either. And I'm sure that reclassifying the Cold War and the war against Islamofascism as world wars is a great way to sell books. I don't doubt that.
You should only be right.
Well,
the figures don't bear you out yet.
A valiant attempt, if nothing else. I'm sure it's very effective to prey on our memories of the world wars that we did fight and how wonderful they were and how we all united as a country and saved the world.
Excuse me, I never said that. I said we did not unite as a country in World War III.
But, thank you. But with due respect, sir, these aren't world wars. I mean, isn't that part of... The entire problem here is that we're thinking about the Cold War and the war against Islamofascism as world wars, when the idea of a world war is a bit of an antiquity. That's not what we're fighting here. And I'm not saying that the Cold War and the war against Islamofascism aren't struggles that need to be undertaken, but to try to cast them as world wars is just a backward step. I don't understand how you can justify that. It seems historically and intellectually irresponsible to me. And I do respect your opinions. I came here tonight to hear what you had to say and try to learn something new. So to that end, I would like to hear you comment on that.
Yeah. Well, to that end, you ought to buy and read this book, or borrow it and read it. I don't care. Look, what can I say? If you don't think that the Cold War was a world war, I honestly don't know what you make of the language. I mean, the Cold War, which I insist is World War III, was fought on a global battlefield all over the world, virtually, and by many different instrumentalities of power. It was a unified struggle against an enemy with very multifarious facets, and took a long time to win. If that wasn't a world war, well, I don't know. I mean, it was more of a world war in a way than World War I was, which was mainly fought on a single battlefield. As for this one, it's also global in reach. There have been battles and episodes ranging from the Middle East all through Western Europe. And going into countries like as far-flung as Bali and others, Indonesia. It is a worldwide struggle against an enemy which is loosely connected, which I call Islamofascism. You don't want to call it a world war. I mean, I don't know exactly what advantage you derive from I actually think it is a new way to think about it. But even if it were an old way to think about it, that wouldn't make it false. I believe that the analysis holds up. And I don't know quite how to answer your question except to say that I believe it's the best way to think about it, the most illuminating way to think about it, and the way that will help us in understanding what we're involved in and why the struggle is so important to engage and win. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Podhoretz.
Hi, David. I thought I saw you in the dark room.
Let's get right off.
David, how are you? Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.